Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The flight of the Taliban from cities across Afghanistan tempts Americans to dream for a moment of U.S. troops coming home of our own ticker tape parades out of Afghanistan. In fact, the plot may be about to thicken. In this hour, we talk with the Washington Post's Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent Thomas E. Ricks. He grew up in Afghanistan. He grew worldwise watching America's soldiers at work. He'll give us the straight story. First, eight Western aid workers held by the Taliban since August 3rd are in Pakistan tonight and appear to be safe. Ed Donahue is a reporter with the Associated Press in Washington, D.C. He's covering the story. Hello, Ed. What can you tell us about the latest news on the released workers, aid workers?
Well, we're getting a word now that three special U.S. Forces helicopters picked up the aid workers in a field about 50 miles southwest of Kabul in the town of Ghanzi this afternoon. That's according to the Pentagon, and the aid workers were flown to Pakistan, and the word we're getting from the Pentagon is that they appear to be in pretty good health. It's not really clear at this point whether the Taliban released the aid workers or they escaped or were freed by U.S. forces. Now, the situation was that these aid workers, including two Americans, Dana Curry and Heather Mercer, went along with the Taliban troops once they left Kabul. And they were taken along with them. They said it was for their own protection, for their own safety. So they have been on the run with the Taliban troops, and they were taken from the town of Ghanzi about 50 miles from Kabul this afternoon, and we're now getting word that they are back in Pakistan, and they appear to be in good health.
Ed, is there reason to believe that the release was the result of active negotiations with the Taliban? Do we have any idea?
No word yet on what the motives were for this. President Bush has rejected several times attempts by the Taliban to use these aid workers as a bargaining chip. The president will be making a statement shortly from his ranch in Texas.
But you say we do know that three U.S. helicopters went in to pick them up. Do we know where those helicopters flew in from?
Not sure yet from the Pentagon where they flew from, no.
And why was the Taliban holding the aid workers? Were they as kind of hostages against a possible U.S. attack? I guess that's a moot point now.
Well, originally they were arrested and they were to face trial in Afghanistan on charges of preaching Christianity in Muslim Afghanistan. And they were still held on September 11th after the terrorist attacks. And the families of all the aid workers, including the two American aid workers, have been very concerned about their safety, about what was going to happen to them while all this fighting was going on in Afghanistan.
You say that the word is that the aid workers are in fairly good shape?
That's what we're hearing from U.S. officials. This situation where they were picked up in a field by military forces, not really clear as to how they got to this field, whether they had escaped or whether U.S. forces had to come in to free them. But we're getting word now that they appear to be in good health.
The Pentagon has been very clear that it's been attacking Taliban forces fleeing Kabul and elsewhere. It must have been dangerous when they were taken out of their prison cells in Kabul, however they were leaving the city. Who's briefing on this tonight? Is it the Pentagon or the White House?
We were hearing from the White House, and I'm sure we have a reporter at the Pentagon who is waiting for more word on exactly what is happening, at least the word getting from there. We'll surely be hearing from the Pentagon. And also in Pakistan, once these people get out, I imagine they will be briefed, and then they'll meet up with their families, and I'm sure they have quite a huge story to tell.
Quite a story to tell. Ed Donahue, thank you very much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Ed Donahue is a reporter with the Associated Press in Washington, D.C. When Tom Ricks organized his high school class field trip, the destination was Bamiyan, Afghanistan, long before the Taliban blew up Bamiyan's famous Buddhas this spring. Ricks was a schoolboy in Kabul, in love with the mountains that are now battlefields. He came home to become a journalist and burrowed into the heart of the U.S. military, with Marine Corps recruits in his book Making the Corps, and with grunts and top brass in battle zones around the world. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his deep reporting on U.S. military reform. He came out just just this year with a new novel, A Soldier's Duty, that puts an angry and alienated U.S. infantry in Afghanistan. We're turning to Tom Ricks tonight for the latest, and we hope the clearest report on what's actually happening with the U.S. military in Afghanistan right now against the backdrop of his own experience there. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Tom Ricks. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
We're real good, thank you. Tom, you just heard, I think, the story that we're getting on the eight aid workers released or rescued, we don't know which yet, by the U.S. military. Do you have any insight on that before we move in?
I don't. I think you know what I know at this point.
Yeah, what a wild story.
The one thing is, I would correct, the town I think they're talking about is Ghazni, which is the major town between Kabul and Kandahar. It's about 50, 60 miles southwest of Kabul. And interestingly is where the word sultan comes from.
Draw the link for us.
The first person who was ever a sultan was Sultan Mahmud of Ghazni, who had an empire, I can't think, what, about 910,000 years ago, based in Ghazni that extended across the whole region.
It comes right down to the town where eight people have walked to freedom via U.S. helicopters tonight. Tom, let's step back for a second here. We want to get your take on what's going on with U.S. military in Afghanistan. But first, we want to understand your perspective. You actually spent several years of school there when your father was teaching at the university in Kabul. When was that? What was that like? And what extra dimension does that give to your view of what's going on there today?
I lived there from 1969 to 71 and went back again in 1977 after I graduated from college and spent a summer knocking around. And the thing that amazed me about the place is what a magical country it was. So what I find now as I cover this war here from Washington is sort of these two parts of my life colliding, memories floating up when I read about, oh, this place was struck, or, oh, Baghi Bala restaurant, it'll say that's where Osama bin Laden hangs out, and I'll think, oh, that's where I used to go drink beer with my friends.
You know, for most Americans, it doesn't sound like such a magic place. The images are of Afghans fighting Soviets, a very brutal conflict of the Taliban, you know, forcing folks into a very strict Islamic way of life, and women forced into a kind of really oppressed position there. What was magic about it before all the hell and the fire came down?
Well, look, the Afghans were never McGovernites, but I think the last 20 years have really brutalized the country. I'm amazed when I look at photographs of Kabul, how much it looks like Richmond at the end of the Civil War in 1865.
Flattened.
What I remember is a country of poets, a country of storytellers, and a wonderful geography that really fit the culture. I think back to the oddity that there are four major river systems in Afghanistan, but only one reaches the sea. Two go into an inland sea, the Aral Sea in Central Asia, and
that's a truly landlocked country.
The fourth just dries up in the desert on the Iranian-Afghan border.
We've heard that there was this period in the mid-70s when the Americans were involved in nation building or aid projects at that time. Perhaps your father was part of that. And a lot of people who lived there at that time or who were youths there at that time look back on it with great fondness.
My old high school in Kabul that is very active. Everybody who attended there seems to write in constantly about Afghanistan. It really does leave its mark on people, the country. But yes, U.S. aid and Russian aid were very active in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And they kind of divided up the country in half. So the Americans would build the Kabul to Kandahar road, and then the Russians would build the Kandahar to Herat road. Mm-hmm. The Americans built the airport in Kandahar that apparently has been the subject of fighting over the last couple of days. It's a wonderful, large airport with nice housing in it. That I'm told was taken over by the Al-Qaeda network and was made into a major base for Osama bin Laden and his buddies.
So far, the part of the U.S. military involvement with Afghanistan that we've heard about has been mainly from sky to ground, that is the bombing campaign. Do you anticipate a much deeper involvement on the ground there? And what face or shape do you think it might have, Tom?
I think there will have to be more involvement on the ground in the south. I'm not necessarily sure it'll be extensive. It will be deeper. The character of the war, I think, is about to change. The war in the north, north of the Hindu Kush, down to Kabul, Hindu Kush being the mountains that divide the country in two, north-south, mm-hmm. The war up until now was basically American air power in support of allies on the ground, the Northern Alliance. But for several reasons, you don't want the Northern Alliance to do the South. They're not Southerners, and the Pashtuns would resent that. Also, it's not clear you really need an armed force in the South as much as you simply want to evaporate the atmosphere of support. So you don't want armed Pashtuns running around in giant armies either.
So how do you treat it?
Well, that does raise the question. So what do you do? Well, what we appear to be doing in the last 24 hours is putting small numbers of U.S. forces in. Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, said today to do roadblocks on the Kabul-Kandahar road to start sorting people out, which kind of answers your question of how did these aid workers perhaps escape being bombed. The United States was saying it was being very careful about hitting vehicles moving south out of Kabul. It was not being indiscriminate, they emphasized.
So this isn't like our attack on the Iraqis fleeing Kuwait City.
That's right. They did not want it to look like a highway of death in the eyes of the Arab world. I think they also didn't want to kill a lot of civilians, and they were worried, especially, they said, because the Taliban had stolen a lot of non-governmental organizations, charity groups, vehicles. So you couldn't simply look at a vehicle and say, oh, that's a good guy or that's a bad guy. You had to get eyes on, as the military says. So the special forces went in and established these roadblocks, I think, today to check that out and also to do things like look for these aid workers.
Tom, in your latest novel, A Soldier's Duty, you portray Afghanistan as a hideous meat grinder for U.S. troops. That's a face that we haven't seen yet.
We haven't, and I really hope we don't see it. So far, the U.S. military has been extraordinarily adept in how it thinks about Afghanistan and deals with it. And really, I want to say hats off to the military for grasping that situation. I think it helps that a key person in all this, Zalmay Khalilzad, a former Pentagon official who now works at the White House, is a native of Afghanistan. He's on the National Security Council, is actually born in Mazar-i-Sharif. Only in America can you bring that sort of sensitivity to invading another country, is that you have a native of that country advising you as part of your government.
On your Security Council.
Yeah, on the National Security Council. But they really, I think, have brought an understanding, a sensitivity to the Arab world, repeatedly emphasizing we are not looking to be like the Soviets here. We're not looking to invade this country. We don't want to occupy territory. We have a very specific and narrow objective, which is to go after the Al-Qaeda network and their allies in the Taliban. And then we want to go home.
It was only
and
a few days.
They're very clear. Afghanistan to be run by the Afghans.
But it was only a few days ago that it appeared that maybe all the Islamic world was seeing was the bombing and the elements of destruction that ensued from that. It felt like the Pentagon was playing this thing very close to the edge. Was it ever as close to the edge as we perceived?
I'm not sure what you mean by close to the edge.
Well, close to the edge in the sense of maybe this thing would spiral out of control. Maybe we would provoke so much Islamic world anger that whatever we achieved would be dust in our hands.
Well, it's not over yet. Remember that. And it still could turn to dust in our hands. Afghanistan has a nasty history, or an intelligent history as well, of permitting invasion, of letting a big military roll right in, and then settling back and dealing with them in their own timetable. The Soviets in 1979 took Afghanistan in a week. They took the airfields, they took the cities. They spent the next 10 years losing that war until they finally retreated in 1989 and left.
That's an
object
lesson.
I don't think it's going to happen here, but it is something you want to keep in mind, is that for the Afghans, the Taliban especially, some Taliban may think the war has just begun. And that's clearly going to be the issue in the South. How do we achieve our aims without becoming enmeshed in the South, do what we want to do, and leave?
And can we continue without getting Pakistan any further involved?
Apparently so. I think we've had what the military calls a very small footprint in Pakistan. They've been very sensitive to that as well. I remember a Pentagon official saying to me one day that, look, we understand that winning in Afghanistan and losing Pakistan in the process is not a net gain. Because then you wind up, if Pakistan were to fall into the hands of Islamic extremists, with a nation that is both Islamic extremist and has nuclear weapons. So you don't want that to happen, and they're being very careful to ensure it doesn't happen. But the story is not over yet. Afghanistan has a way of popping nasty surprises, and the Pentagon is being very clear that they're trying to tamp down the euphoria and say, look, we are thinking about surprises here. We do want to be careful about what happens next.
We're talking this hour with Thomas E. Ricks. He's military correspondent for the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who's covered the Pentagon and grew up in Afghanistan. We're looking for insight as things fall in unexpected directions for most of us watching what's going on from Kabul and around the country. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with Washington Post military correspondent Thomas E. Ricks. He won a Pulitzer Prize for covering issues of military reform. Now he's watching the Pentagon pursue its war in Afghanistan and potentially beyond. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Might this go down as a textbook success for the U.S. military? Or, well, are we over the hump? Or are the real booby traps still ahead? You can join our conversation on the phone or online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Tom Ricks, you were talking earlier on about Afghanistan as a nation where you grew up in part, as a nation of warrior poets. How does that emerge? Are you seeing that in the fight that's been underway in the last 2 months, the fight most Americans are familiar with, or is it always there somehow?
It's always there, I think. It's the background of Afghanistan. Basically, guerrilla warfare is their national sport. But the warrior poet combines in the figure of the very strong rhetoric you hear sometimes out of Afghan fighters. And they're really their ideal, their hero, in the same way that I guess John Wayne is one of our culture heroes, is the warrior poet, the killer who leads his tribe but also proclaims it in great poetry, rhetorical poetry, especially among the Pashtuns. I was actually looking at some poetry today I brought with me.
Oh, great.
Here's a Pashtun sort of double couplet. Give me two things, then let the British come. A gun to fight with that won't jam. A girl to fight next to who will love. And here's a couplet from a mother. Mm. From a lover. Mm-hmm. My beloved returned unsuccessful from battle. I regret the kiss I gave him last night.
That's a country that almost seems to love war. How do you come to a peace that will last in a land of warrior poets?
I think you go settle down to what they call low-intensity conflict. I mean, when I lived in Kabul, the central government in Kabul had a kind of tenuous hold beyond the suburbs of Kabul, and occasionally was kind of at war with various tribes and so on. There is a warlord tradition there. A lot of people still live in semi-fortresses. If you go out to the countryside, you see kind of these mud fortresses that people live in a lot of villages, especially in the mountains.
Mm-hmm. Tom, next up on the U.S. docket is going after al-Qaeda in a more targeted way and hoping to find Osama bin Laden. How do you think the U.S. military will pursue that goal?
I think right now they're gathering a lot of intelligence in the South. They're watching the very panicky movement of Taliban and al-Qaeda as they find that some of their hiding places no longer exist. That was the purpose of some of the bombing over the last 5 weeks, is to take away those little hide holes and those tents and so on. This is kind of the You Can't Go Home Again campaign. When you hop in your SUV from Kabul and said, okay, time to head for the hills, mm-hmm. you get there and you find maybe the pass is blocked by rubble or the cave where you'd stored all your goods, your ammunition and your fuel, has been bombed by bunker busters that burrowed in and destroyed all your ammunition and fuel. That's what the military happily calls a secondary explosion in those videos the Pentagon shows every day. Mm-hmm. So you figure out where these guys are. You also have people turning sides and saying, you know, I used to be kind of Taliban, but now I'm kind of not. And as a sign of good faith, I'll tell you about some things I know. And they're also offering over the radio in Afghanistan now $25 million $25 million for information leading to the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden. $25 million will make you the king of your valley and your descendants for many decades to come in Afghanistan. That's a lot of rice and fuel and rocket-propelled grenades.
How low profile is it possible for Osama bin Laden to travel in Afghanistan, if indeed he's still there? Could he go incognito, or does he necessarily travel with a party that would be recognizably different from just some camel train?
In the past, he has been recognizable, according to the Northern Alliance, who have told people that he usually traveled very specifically in a caravan of 7 black SUVs. So you wouldn't want to be driving in a large group of SUVs around Afghanistan right now. the United States has been operating these fascinating unmanned aircraft called Predators with Hellfire anti-tank missiles attached. And you've got some operator sitting back here in an Air Force base in the United States looking through his camera, which comes up through a satellite, and if he sees a caravan of seven black SUVs skedaddling south from Kabul, I think he's likely to launch a few Hellfire missiles at them.
Presumably Osama bin Laden is no longer wearing the power suit of seven black SUVs, though. What if he's just with, donkeys or camels or on foot and looks like any other farmer or a goat herd?
Or as I saw one person refer to it, just ZZ Top and Army Surplus.
Oh, jeez. Yes
and no. I mean, he could blend in a little bit. This is a basic problem, though, for the al-Qaeda network. They are foreigners in Afghanistan. The Afghans are not Arabs. And a lot of Afghans don't have a lot of time for Arabs. They are foreigners, and the Afghans don't like foreigners of any type particularly. They're very hospitable, but they don't want foreigners pushing them around and running their country, as has been the case with al-Qaeda. So if you're Taliban and you're Afghan, you can kind of melt into the woodwork a little bit. It's a much harder case for these several thousand foreign fighters who have come into Afghanistan and have been there, some of them even for 10 years. These are Arabs, Pakistanis, Chechens, various people who originally came in to do the very good work of getting the Russians out of Afghanistan and then overstayed their welcome, and more came in. Those guys are in very bad shape. As one Pentagon official said to me earlier this week, they are now strangers in a strange land. Especially up in the north, there's this one last pocket up in the north called Kunduz, a nice little town where there are now several thousand Taliban stuck with no real hope of getting out. And among them, there are at least several hundred foreign fighters, these al-Qaeda allies. That's a very bad situation to be in. I'm not quite sure how they're going to get out of there, if they ever will. And the United States doesn't want them to. The Defense Secretary has used the word kill very explicitly, more than I've ever heard a Defense Secretary say this. We want to kill them. We want to kill al-Qaeda. We want to kill the hardcore Taliban allies. And that's exactly what they're doing right now.
And I wonder how they'll pursue that as they go forward. They've blocked some passes, as you say. They've bombed caves. They've put up roadblocks. They're gathering intelligence on, and maybe they're monitoring from somewhere in Virginia the images coming back from the drones flying over. What will they do on the ground? Will there be many more parties of special forces now running around, going up every ravine, looking in every crevice in all those mountains?
I think they'll be doing that sort of thing, but not just randomly. I think they'll be following up on specific intelligence, whether it's from pushtoons on the ground or from imagery they get from overhead, or intelligence intercepts of communications. I think they will be chasing into various corners to see what they find and how they find and shaking it out. What strikes me is how careful they're being to have, first of all, a small footprint, a small logistical impact, both in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and how careful they really are trying to be to avoid so-called collateral damage, that is, killing civilians and so on. They are not indiscriminately bombing. The bombing, even out of the B-52s, has been pretty targeted about trying to hit very specific targets or Taliban front lines. Now, of course, you don't have those Taliban front lines. There is no front line anymore. And it is potentially a much messier war because of that.
We're talking this hour with Tom Ricks, Thomas E. Ricks. He's military correspondent for the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize-winning observer of the Pentagon. He's grew up in Kabul in part and has been watching very closely as the war on terrorism unfolds. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you think? Is the Taliban finished in Afghanistan? Will Osama bin Laden ever be caught? And how do you think the U.S. military is doing in this unusual, this new kind of war, as our president says, in Afghanistan and beyond? Tom Ricks, do you see lessons from the wars and mini wars and peacekeeping operations of the last 10 or 15 years being learned and acted on in Afghanistan today by the U.S. military?
It's a good question. I think we are. I think the U.S. military is an extraordinarily professional organization right now that never was really prepared for this sort of war. They were basically training to fight the Soviets in the plains of Central Europe, to slug it out with the Red Army. Nobody joined the U.S. military saying, I want to go fight a bunch of terrorists in Afghanistan. And it's to their credit that they took on this mission, tried to approach it, dealing with the various sensitivities of not wanting to have a big impact on Pakistan, of not wanting to turn broad Arab opinion against you, yet still to be effective. and they've done it so far. It was striking that for 4 weeks there were few signs of any progress. And they said, we think it'll be coming, be patient.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came, it was precipitous. But for 4 weeks, there was no real evidence of progress. And then suddenly you had this very swift movement of the Northern Alliance across half that country.
And they drew a lot of skepticism during those 4 weeks.
Yeah, I remember one newspaper, not mine, had a story about how this was a quagmire, reminiscent of Vietnam.
That word was floating around.
But even my paper was skeptical, saying, look, you know, where is the signs of progress? And when I went to talk to Pentagon officials, they would say, look, there is nothing yet. There are no signs of progress. We think they will be coming. But they were also very clear that this was not a fixed playbook. The classic U.S. military operation resembles football. There's a fixed playbook. Mm-hmm. We're going to do this. You guys go out on the left. You do that. This was soccer, improvisational.
Mm-hmm.
Reacting to events on the ground. Where's the ball? What are we doing today? What do we need to know today that we didn't know yesterday? And how do we react differently because of that?
Tom, we have callers who want to join the conversation. Let's let them come in. We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking with Thomas E. Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post. What do you think of the great soccer game unfolding in Afghanistan and perhaps soon beyond? Dan is on the line from Buffalo, New York. Welcome, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Tom.
Sure.
My question is, what do you think the Taliban, the Northern Alliance's position will be at this point on their stance as far as sharing power now in a government with the other tribes in a democratic fashion, being that they were really the main force in Afghanistan to take out the Taliban? How willing do you think they will be to share power now with the other tribes in a new government?
We'll put it to Tom Ricks. Thanks for your call, Dan. What about it, Tom? How willing will the Northern Alliance be? They've got Kabul. They've got the first place position at the moment. Do you think they'll open up and be ready to share power? They have a choice.
Well, I think their position is going to be possession is 9/10 of the law. You know, let's talk about what I'm going to give you. I think the Americans, and very much at the urging of the Pakistanis, are going to say, not so fast, fellas. First of all, we have a lot of military might in the region, and we're not going home right now, you notice. We're putting more forces out there, even as we speak.
But what's our leverage? What's the leverage of that military power over our allies?
Well, we've always been clear that at some point their interests and ours might diverge. I don't think we're going to attack them, but I think our leverage is going to be financial. We're going to say, look, there's a big aid package that we're putting together here, multinational, and if you want part of that, you need to start talking about the political future of Afghanistan and power sharing. And essentially, we'll say, the sooner that you guys get your act together politically with the power sharing with Pashtuns, the sooner you'll see this country begin to reconstruct it in the way it desperately needs. Basically, the two things that country needs are rebuilding of its road network to take advantage of trade across Central Asia to the subcontinent that you haven't had. And the second thing is rebuilding of its irrigation network. It's a desert country that you have to pull the water out of the mountains through canals out to the desert. And large parts of those canals have been destroyed over the last 20 years of warfare.
So what's your guess, Tom? Knowing Afghans as you do, are they prepared now to become the petri dish for Western nation building? Is it, in fact, a good candidate for turning into a kind of Garden of Eden that will be the envy of the rest of the Islamic world and signal that it's good to work with the United States and the coalition?
Yes and no. I mean, I love that country. I think they understand that they need to do something like that to pull it together. At the same time, since I stopped living there, it's a country that's been brutalized by 20 years of unspeakable warfare. This country's still in shock from losing 5,000 people on September 11th. The Afghans lost 1 million people during the Soviet war, and an untold number additional since then. The other thing I should have mentioned the country desperately needs is mine clearance. There are millions of mines spread across Afghanistan. And before that country can really start growing food again, in large parts of it, you need to start clearing out those mines. The downside is it's a country that also enjoys revenge and had a lot of bitter experiences. I was thinking today about another old Pashtun saying, and I'm not a Pashtun saying, an anti-Pashtun saying,
all right,
quoted in a book I was reading. It was a proverb that said, "Trust a snake before a whore, and a whore before a Pashtun."
I would
so that's
call
gonna
that
be on the mind. It's going to be on the minds of the Northern Alliance, I think, as they sit down to the bargaining table.
Yeah, I would call that pretty anti-Pushtun. We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking with Tom Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post. You can join our conversation, 1-800-423-TALK. Bruce is on the line. Welcome, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hi. Hello. Hi. I'm interested in about Afghanistan. Are these different ethnic groups close to one another? Do they speak the same language? Is it a real nation, or has it been just put on the map by, the British or some other Western group?
We got it. We'll put it to Tom Ricks. Thanks for your call, Bruce. How about it, Tom? How similar or different, how deeply divided, and is it a real nation or a potential country at least?
There are lots of very distinct ethnic groups. The most distinct is the Hazaras of the central mountains, who look very Mongol. Another distinct group is up in the northeast. The Nuristanis have a lot of blondes and redheads and claim to be descended from Alexander the Great's troops.
Mm-hmm.
The basic division in the country is both geographical and ethnic, though. The Hindu Kush is this wonderful mountain range, 15 to 25,000 feet tall, that goes right across the middle of the country and divides it into north and south. And when the winter comes and closes the passes, until you had the passes cleared in modern times, and you could go by airplane as well, the country really divided into two for several months during the winter. In the north, you have Uzbeks, Tajiks, and other ethnic groups. They look a little bit more Mongol, more East Asian, a little bit Chinese, some of them. Even the bread is different. It's round in the north. In the south, you have Pushtuns. The bread is different. It looks more like a big old snowshoe. They're non. And the language is different. The north and the west speak Farsi more, which is kind of
an Afghan Persian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the south, they speak Dari. In the south, they speak Pushtun.
Mm-hmm.
Dari is another word for Farsi. I'm sorry. So it's basically two basic languages, Pushtun and a kind of derivative of Persian.
And what about Bruce's question? You hear this repeated a lot lately in the United States, is does this geographic area hang together as a modern nation, as we think of a modern nation?
No, it's certainly not like the nations we know. But look, it can be Afghanistan again, I think, in which you have uneasy truces in various parts of the country. It's always been an armed country. In that way, it actually resembles the U.S. Or the U.S. frontier in the 19th century, mm-hmm. much more than it resembles, say, any European nation.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Afghans, when I lived in the late 60s and early 70s, carried rifles over their shoulders wherever they went. These are people who really like a good firearm. Think of a nation of Clint Eastwood wearing turbans.
And you've got Afghanistan.
That'll get you a lot of way towards Afghanistan, yeah.
Clint Eastwood with turbans. You can join this conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Clint Eastwood with turbans is the picture we're getting from Tom Ricks. We're going to come back after a break and talk about how the Pentagon is handling this latest challenge, the biggest challenge in a decade in the Middle East, probably the biggest since the Gulf War, and in a challenge in a new kind of war, as President George Bush describes it. Thomas E. Ricks is with us. He's a military correspondent for The Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter covering reform issues at the Pentagon. He's written in depth about the military and in a most recent novel, A Soldier's Diary, about war in Afghanistan. It wasn't a pretty picture. The U.S. picture has been prettier so far than that, but who knows what lies ahead. Join our conversation here or online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Washington Post military correspondent Thomas E. Ricks about the situation in Afghanistan and the U.S. military there. With all the developments of the last couple days, are we over the hump or are the real booby traps still ahead? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sean is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Sean. You're on the air.
Good evening. I was wondering whether the push seems to be coming from the north and from the east. In this push and pushing Osama, obviously, westward, is mm-hmm. the hope that we're going to be going into Iran and Iraq and be able to take care of the Iraqi situation at that point.
Sean, thanks for your call. Tom, I guess it's about might Osama bin Laden end up in Iraq, and might the U.S. government, the Pentagon, actually want him there so we can maybe finish up the business from the Gulf War?
No, I think the U.S. government's been very clear. They want Osama bin Laden, just one thing. They want him dead. But there is a real worry that the caller points to here. Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, spoke privately to his commanders about this in late September, which is, look, he said, I think we're going to be successful in Afghanistan, and that means that al-Qaeda will start fleeing from Afghanistan. Let's think about where they go next and how to catch them en route. And there is now a global U.S. military plan for dealing with that eventuality, which is probably happening as we speak. You probably have some al-Qaeda and some Taliban fleeing into Pakistan. Rumsfeld brought this up yesterday in an interesting way at the press conference at the Pentagon. When he began, in his opening statement, without any questions, he began by saying, enlisting several countries where al-Qaeda has operated in the past. He said Somalia and Sudan. He listed several other countries that he said are states where terrorists have been housed. And he said Iraq, Libya, North Korea. And I think he was putting those countries on notice, which is, we're watching your behavior. The amnesty box is open. Whatever you did before September 11th, we're not going to worry about. What matters is what you do now. Do not let these people come to your country.
What's the size of the al-Qaeda force, Tom, or the germ at the heart of it that's most important? Are we talking about a sizable contingent of men here?
We are. We're talking about several thousand people. The real nexus between Taliban and al-Qaeda is a unit called the 55th Brigade, or some people call it 055 Brigade. It's a Taliban unit that it mainly has foreign fighters in it, as I understand it. These guys who come in from Pakistan and the Arab states and so on, and Chechnya, and really became the military might of the Taliban, the assault force of the Taliban. And this always, among intelligence analysts, has raised the question, who really is the guest and who really is the host? Mm-hmm. Is Osama bin Laden the guest of Taliban or the host of the Taliban? Mm-hmm. Some people think he's the guy, he and the people around him, who really managed to put Taliban in power. And the Pentagon analysis has been, by killing that brigade, specifically the 055 Brigade, that you really cut the military support for the Taliban and forced them to flee, and also forced al-Qaeda to flee, and took away its military arm.
Do you sense a feeling of confidence at the Pentagon right now that they've cowed these nations that they're speaking to? Donald Rumsfeld speaks to from the podium there that they're not going to take al-Qaeda, that they're going to have them in a box canyon in Afghanistan and, as you say, kill them?
It strikes me, listening to Rumsfeld today, he was speaking at the World Trade Center site in New York, and a reporter said something about, what are you going to do when you find these people? And he said, when we find people that we want to shoot, we'll shoot them. You usually don't hear defense secretaries speaking that flatly and explicitly about killing people. They're very clear that 5,000 Americans died because of these people, and they are going to die for it.
There's not much ambiguity about that. We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking with Tom Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post. David is on the line. Welcome, David.
Thank you. My question relates to military hardware. Mr. Ricks' opinion about what are unique new decisive weapons that might compare to the Gulf War's use of the stealth fighter and laser-guided munitions. Anything new that's come up that you find interesting and decisive?
Let's hear. Thanks, David. What do you say, Tom?
The single most interesting piece of hardware, I think, is this unmanned combat aerial vehicle. Never before have you had an aircraft up there that actually shoots missiles or bullets, but doesn't have a pilot in it. That really is a departure in the history of warfare. I think that this world will be remembered for that. I don't think it's been that decisive. I think really the decisive thing is something that doesn't shoot at all. It's the American ability, unparalleled in the world now, to collect and analyze and act on intelligence. And here I'm talking about things like unmanned aircraft that are just up there constantly circling above Afghanistan, from the Predator, which flies fairly low, to the Global Hawk, which is a long loiter aircraft that flies forever, for I think 46 hours. Its wingspan is bigger than a 737, and it carries all these cameras and things that intercept information, and it's just up there forever. I think every major Taliban leader probably has a personal Predator circling him at all, above him at all times now. So I think really the decisive and memorable weapon in this conflict is something that doesn't kill anybody at all, simply gathers information. That's the American intelligence and information gathering complex.
Tom, how far does that mean the United States has come toward its vision of the reformed military, the super high-tech military that would turn every battlefield into a kind of cube of awareness?
It means they've made a great leap. I think they may be about as far as you're going to get in this situation, though, because ultimately at the end of every conflict, it comes down to boots on the ground, and that's the phase we're at now. You've got to put people on the ground somehow in the conflict. And that's always been the question that other nations have about Americans. Yes, we know you're very high tech. Your Sony PlayStations are better than most of our computers. But will you die on the ground? It's been amazing to me that America has not had that many casualties. We've had a couple of accidents, but no combat losses in this war so far. The rest of the world is going to watch and see how we behave when we if we do suffer those sort of casualties.
Tom, let's take another call. Ann is on the line. Welcome, Ann. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I wanted to put in the point that since Osama bin Laden has said that if we used nuclear weapons against him, he would retaliate in kind, that this would be a very good time not to use depleted uranium-hardened missiles, which would spread radioactivity all over the place, as we've done previously, unfortunately, in the past.
Mm. Thanks, Ann. We just got a little bit of time. But, Tom, are we using those hardened missiles? And what about the nuclear issue? It seems to just grow larger in the background.
Yeah, you don't want to confuse depleted uranium bullets with nuclear weapons. That's like confusing a bullet with a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
They're very different things. But they have spread some radioactivity in the past. It's true.
Still, the issue this points to is the Al-Qaeda's access potentially to nuclear material or even a weapon.
Do I think he has it? No. Do we want to make everything, take every possible step to ensure he doesn't have it? Absolutely, yes. I think when he said that, it only increased the determination of the U.S. government to eradicate him from the face of the earth as fast as possible.
Tom, do you think he's still in Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden?
Yeah, I bet he is. I was struck with this interview he did the other day with a Pakistani journalist. The journalist was driven 5 hours from Kabul, he said. Well, with the condition of the roads in Afghanistan now, that's not going to get you much
not
more than 150 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's probably in northeastern Afghanistan somewhere. Remember, this guy's a zealot. He's not thinking rationally. If I were him, I would have shaved off my beard long ago and be driving a taxi in Brooklyn at this point. But he's not. He's leading his own, you know, what he seems to see as a massive war on the West. And I think he's determined to fight it out to the bitter end and will happily die for his cause.
And Tom, talk to us for a minute about the U.S. coverage of the war overall. And I know you're part of that, but there's been this back and forth kind of feeling. There was a lot of initial surge of confidence. Then there was a sense that, oh, my, this is going to take longer than we thought, and maybe we're the next Soviet Union. Has it been too negative, too positive, right on the mark? How would you assess U.S. media's coverage of the war?
In one word, befuddled. And I include myself in that group. We don't know what's going on to a surprising degree. The Pentagon, more than in any other war, including the Gulf War, has restricted the release of information. Basically, Donald Rumsfeld has become the sole source of information on this war.
That's a pretty narrow spigot.
Yeah, it's basically one guy who's telling you what's going on in the war. There are no troops out. There are no reporters out with the ground troops who are in Uzbekistan now. To my knowledge, we've never had a U.S. ground combat deployment of regular troops. Didn't have reporters attached to it.
As a reporter, that's a tough situation. Put yourself in the military shoes. Is it the right thing or the wrong thing for a democracy fighting this strange new kind of war?
Well, clearly Donald Rumsfeld, I think, thinks it's the right thing. Some people in the military think it isn't. They would like to have Americans know what they're up to. Rumsfeld's view is that this is a new kind of war and has to be covered differently. I've heard an interesting counterview, not from a reporter, which I think would be dismissed as biased, but from a retired Green Beret officer I know named Bob Killebrew, who said he really worries that we're not playing on the American strength of the free flow of information. He said, much more than a kinetic war of killing, this is a cultural war of information. And Killebrew's argument was we should be as open as possible here. He said he'd like to have a reporter on every Ranger parachute drop, flying in strike aircraft, out there at every operation. His view is basically, look, if you're proud of what you're doing, and we should be, and if you think you're doing the right thing, and he thinks we are, show the world. Don't imitate your adversary. Don't be secretive.
That would
be
a revolution. Tom, we're out of time. We thank you very much for joining us. Thomas E. Ricks is military correspondent for The Washington Post, author most recently of A Soldier's Diary, his latest
novel.
Actually,
A Soldier's Duty, I should say.
A Soldier's Duty. I apologize, Tom.
Yes.
A Soldier's Duty from Random House. Thanks very much for joining us this evening, Thomas E. Ricks.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Tailgating at football games is a quintessentially American tradition. This fall, the early parking lot crowds at stadiums around the nation have had a lot more to talk about than football. Before last weekend's game between the University of Alabama Crimson Tide and the Mississippi State Bulldogs in Birmingham, Alabama, tailgaters talked about terrorism, charity, and hope.
Football in the South. Tailgating on Saturday afternoons at the stadium.
I'm Sandra Dare from Suwanee, Georgia. I'm a full-time homemaker involved in a lot of charities. And I've become involved in a charity project making teddy bears to be delivered to children of the firemen in New York. They'll be personally delivered in 1st of December. So we've tried to share our talents with people who were directly affected by the tragedy. It gives you a little feeling of contributing something. We're so far from the actual site. But this way, you know, we can share our thoughts and let them know that people in other areas of the country were affected by it and are still thinking about them even 2 months later. I'm the president of a charity that I work almost full-time for, making layettes for disadvantaged babies in North Georgia. So we're always concerned about babies and children. Indirectly, it's probably going to increase the need for our layettes in North Georgia as more of the National Guard are called up and their salaries are decreased, and also the economy situation, more people will be out of work, so there will probably be more babies born who do need our layettes. So we're trying to recruit more volunteers and increase the number of bags we're making to be prepared to provide more.
I'm David Wallace. I'm a senior minister of the First United Methodist Church in downtown Birmingham. I'm originally from a small town in North Alabama, Hartsel. The ministry of First United Methodist Church and my particular goals have changed since September the 11th. Our staff has been very sensitive to all ages. We have seen needs among children, among youth, among families, among many young adults in particular. A group of people that's never faced anything like this. I'm 56 years old. I remember Vietnam. I remember some of the things. I was a resident in Birmingham during the civil rights period, but I've never faced anything like this. Our church has already had bomb threats against it because we're located where we are in the midst of the utility companies and the federal court building. Our church attendance increased by approximately 100 to 150 people the week after the attacks. That number is holding up. It doesn't run quite 150 a week more now, but our attendance is still higher. And many of these are young adults who are saying, tell us what we can find scripturally, prayerfully, and in small groups of discussion. And part of that is just community support. Part of our ministry now has to do with what we call a developmental ministry, as the needs of reassurance, hope, family ministries, more family time, more community support with cookouts and programs to give people a place not only to be but to socialize with others who are struggling with some of the same things about what do we expect. The threat has become more real. And as the threat becomes more real, it's our belief that the church needs to have a word. Is there a word of God for the people of this day? And we believe there is. And that word is hope, faith, courage, and assurance.
That was Sandra Adair and David Wallace. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is W.